The people who you buy books from, do you have a list of some sort?
No, no, nothing like that.
Do you know of a Miguel Silva?
No, that name does not ring a bell.
You said you knew everyone in town.
You ask a lot of questions for someone who's just looking for a book to read.
Let's get together. I'll say it first. We all love fun. And it's time for Kill Me Cast. Yeah, it's time for Kill Me Cast.
Welcome to Kill Me Cast. Here is your host, Francis Rizzo III.
Thanks, Bernard. Welcome all the Val Pals out there listening to a new episode of KilmerCast. I'm your host, Francis Rizzo III, and I'm here to talk about the films of Val Kilmer, one of the most truly arresting American film actors of the modern era. On this episode, we're checking out Kilmer's role as Maureen, battling corporate schemes, in the 2008 action drama Conspiracy. Joining us to chat about the film and Kilmer's role in it is New Horror Express and all 90s action all the time host, Scott Murphy. Welcome to KilmerCast, Scott.
Oh, thanks very much for having me. It's good to be on the show.
I really appreciate you being here. And I do believe you are the first person I've ever spoken to in my life who's from New Zealand. So obviously you should consider yourself just highly honored.
Well, yeah, I guess. Well, yeah, I'm very new here. I don't know if New Zealanders would say I'm a New Zealander yet. I've only been here a couple months, so moved from Scotland. As listeners might pick up from my accent, I'm not very sure. That's definitely not a New Zealand accent.
Well, it's definitely the second Scottish accent I've had on the show. So that's I'm building a little cadre of Scots for my show. But you're definitely more New Zealand than I will ever be, because I'm here in America. And sure. As I speak to you right now, it's Saturday here in New York, but it's Sunday where you are, which is to me such an odd idea that you're in a whole nother day than from me.
It's very strange. I recently recorded with somebody in LA, and working out that I'm like 21 hours ahead of them is completely insane to me. So
now you just got into New Zealand recently. So you came right in the middle of the lockdown, right?
Yes. So I got basically, me and my partner, I got like a visa last year. She's a New Zealand citizen. And we had to do like the full deal of like coming in and doing like 2 weeks in a quarantine hotel. And
wow.
Yeah, that was something else.
How did you keep yourself sane during all that time?
We just kept ourselves busy, basically, I guess, like with the two podcasts. Basically, I started doing like a job search, for getting a job out here in New Zealand. And I had like a stack of episodes I needed to edit for like both podcasts and stuff like that. And then, obviously having my partner with me was good as well,
it always helps not to be alone.
But yes, we did a lot of things just to keep ourselves busy. I remember we posted a video on Facebook of us just like to try and make sure that we were still moving, just walking up and down the hotel room, like just doing laps of the hotel room. It's the most ridiculous thing in the world.
Now, being new to New Zealand, you probably haven't experienced, and especially new during the lockdown, you haven't experienced a lot of life in New Zealand. Have you been there before?
I came on holiday for about 6 weeks at the end of 2019 because my partner's parents live out here, so we had like spent Christmas with them. Mm-hmm. And that was very surreal because obviously Southern Hemisphere, so it's summer at Christmas time, so like sun outside, Christmas trees in the supermarkets, Christmas music playing. It's very surreal, particularly coming from Scotland.
Yeah, not exactly the same weather at that time of year.
Not at all.
Is there something about life in New Zealand that you particularly find very different from your life in Edinburgh?
So far, not greatly. It's interesting that there is a lot of, I suppose, because a lot of the kind of white immigrants to New Zealand were from the British Isles, and there's a lot of Scottish people over here. And also Edinburgh is the kind of city that almost feels like a town, and Wellington's quite similar to that as well. So it does actually have quite a similar vibe. There's a lot of overlap between Scotland and New Zealand.
Well, that should certainly help your acclimation to this new home.
Sure, for sure, yes.
So as this is KilmerCast, we should talk about your own experience with the Kilmer canon. What would you consider your favorite Val Kilmer film?
So I've listened to the podcast before, and I heard you ask other people this, and I'm not sure I have like a particular, no. I've split my answer up into different parts.
Okay.
So, my favorite Kilmer performance, is Kiss Kiss Bang Bang.
Mm, okay. That's my, great.
My favorite film that Kilmer is in is Heat.
Mm, again, a great film.
And my favorite one where he is the lead is Top Secret. So that's my three-part answer.
That is quite the triumvirate of Val Kilmer films. I definitely can lean in on that Top Secret for sure. That and Real Genius are two of my absolute favorites. And so that being your favorite Val Kilmer lead, I can definitely get down with.
I recently watched Real Genius for the first time, actually.
Oh, wow. So what'd you think of it?
Yeah. I really enjoyed it. I was like, it's a weird mashup. I was like, this is like Ferris Bueller meets War Games.
That's a good way to put it, which is funny because those are both movies of Matthew Broderick.
Yes, bizarrely enough.
Well, before we dive into today's film, let's go back in time a bit.
Gather round as we put Kilmer in context.
Conspiracy was released on February 15, 2008. Very limited release. We'll get into that a little bit. Yeah. But at that time, there was a major tornado outbreak. Again, surprising since today I had a tornado outbreak right by my house, which is odd timing. But this time, a major tornado outbreak across the southern United States left at least 58 people dead at that time. And we're seeing more and more of this environmental catastrophe from climate change. So unfortunately, I think we're going to see more and more of that. Also at this time, primaries were held in America leading up to 2008 presidential election, which had Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, Mike Huckabee, John McCain, and Mitt Romney all picking up wins during the primary. But eventually, as we know, Barack Obama would take away the title as president. Also at this time, Kosovo declared independence from Serbia, which set off a firestorm in Europe because you had groups like Russia were not wanting to allow for that independence by Kosovo. And it just created another fire point for international relations around Eastern Europe, which was obviously during the 90s and early 2000s was a real problem for the world because you had a lot of tumult inside of that area. As somebody from living in Scotland at the time, was this affecting you there? Were you hearing a lot about that?
We're certainly, it was in the news a lot. Yeah, I mean, certainly. I don't know if it didn't really directly affect us. I remember during the earlier conflicts, the earlier kind of Bosnia conflicts, I remember there being like people coming over, refugees and stuff, and people fleeing that part of the world. But I was quite young at the time, growing up in the 90s, but I remember it being on the news a lot, from the Bosnia conflict to the late 90s with the Kosovo conflict and stuff like that. And
We in America, we have such, we're so far removed from that area that we don't get the same kind of like immediacy to it, that we don't see what's going on in, you know, in a tightly packed area like Europe. You're all countries are all bordered up against each other. And I'm sure you get more of an understanding of what's happening when something like that happens and how it goes all through your news. And over here, it might be deeper in the newspaper. People might not even pay attention to it over here.
Yeah, no, it was very much like, obviously in the UK, the biggest news organization is the BBC, and it was very much all that stuff was very much headline news. You know, it was, you know, top of the billing. So, you know, you heard a lot about it for sure.
Also big in the news at that time, Fidel Castro retired as the president of Cuba, because of ill health after nearly 50 years in charge of that island country. And in lighter news, Toshiba announced that it would end their HD DVD format, ending the war with Sony and their Blu-ray disc, which eventually just took over and was the next level. Are you a big physical media guy?
Yeah. I was a bit, you know, because like I say, you know, I grew up in the 90s. I'm 36, you know, so like I first grew up with VHS, mm-hmm. and then I moved to DVD, and you know, I still like have loads of, I still have like a massive DVD collection that's currently in a shipping container coming from Scotland to New Zealand. Hopefully they're all okay. I have hundreds of DVDs, so like you know, so I'm still very much a big physical media person, and now I feel kind of old because I remember like the early DVDs that you'd flip over like an LP halfway through the movie.
Yeah, people, you know, these youngsters, they don't understand the struggle we had. We had to get up and walk across the room to watch the other half of the movie. Exactly. It's too bad that the supply chain issues are affecting you so directly like that. You can't watch your movies.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, I'm kind of bereft. Like I have some things on an external hard drive and stuff like that. But yes, I want my bookcases with all my DVDs and stuff. I want them back.
Oh, absolutely. You feel a little just like unmoored when you don't have that, you know, collection of what you enjoy so much being readily available to you. So yeah, let's take a look at what was at the top of the charts at the time, at least in the US. So first in the charts was Low by Flo Rida. You know this song?
No. I got to say, like, I'm not sure I'm going to know a lot of these. I'm not a big chart guy, particularly around this time. If it was something in the 90s, maybe. But, you know, I'm more of a kind of metalhead. So, like, I'm feeling like a lot of these. Oh, no, I do know this song. Actually, like, listening to it more. Yeah, no, I am aware of this one. Is it?
It's got a crazy catchy hook to it, that's for sure.
Yes. That's very true. Yeah, no, I do. Like, once it gets into the chorus, actually, I'm aware of it, yeah.
And it's funny you mentioned the chorus, because outside of the chorus, the song is mostly forgettable. In fact, it's funny is that the artist, you know, credit for it, Flo Rida, he's not the hook. The hook is T-Pain, so it's like, you know, to have this song be one of the biggest songs of his career, and it's really because of another artist, that's got to kind of eat at you a bit, I would think, if you're one of these you know, guys who has feature artists on your albums.
Yeah, and you just get the song stolen from under you. And that's going to really... And like you say, I think listening to that chorus, I do know that song, and I think that is probably the Flo Rida song that I know. And... well, yeah, it's so bland, the other side of the chorus, but that chorus, yeah, is a great catchy hook, and oh well.
Well, let's listen to a song that has no hook and absolutely no reason to be on the chart, but somehow became the number two song at the time, which was Chris Brown's With You. This is just dull. I mean, this is very slow, very methodical, and there's nothing to this that I understand makes it like, if you have Flo Rida at number one with that just crazy hook, and then you have this, like, how does that compare?
I don't know, like kind of parking the how problematic Chris Brown is to one side. I like, just on a purely musical level, I don't, you know, I'm not a big, you know, I'm not big into like R&B and pop and stuff. Like I said, I'm mainly rock and metal, but like I can appreciate like a good hook and a good pop song. And I just don't understand how Chris Brown became famous at all. Like, I found like most any song that I've heard by him kind of bland, generic R&B. And I don't understand how he got big.
Yeah, I mean, I get that he is a talented dancer. But you know, we have to listen to the songs. I mean, like, you're not going to always watch him dance when you listen to the music. So if the music's not good, I don't know how it became so popular. I mean, the number two song in America is a song that could put me to sleep.
Yeah. It's baffling. I was to do a survey.
Yeah, much better was number three song, which was Don't Stop the Music by Rihanna. Now, this is a classic pop song. Like, this just has so much of a hook to it. It's just, she is just driving with this beat. It's just a fun song.
Yeah. I think I remember the thing that always stands out with me with Rihanna is, like, I remember her song Umbrella became really, really big in the UK because that year, which I think is like the year before this, like 2007, there was like these all these floods happening in the UK and like really bad weather, and like it became the anthem of that whole bit of the year where there was all these floods and stuff, and like you could not avoid it at all. It was, that song was everywhere, but like, yeah, this was big too.
Yeah, I don't think she meant to have her song be accompanied by flooding, but you know, hey, yeah, you take it where you can get it, right?
Yeah.
At this time in New Zealand, even though you weren't living there at the time, I figured I'd talk a little bit about it. The charts are very similar, actually, because Chris Brown was number one with that song, and Flo Rida was number two, and then Leona Lewis was number three with her song Bleeding Love, which was big in Great Britain as well.
Yeah, because I can't remember which of the talent shows she won. I think it was the X Factor.
Yes, it was.
Yeah,
X
that
Factor.
Song was massive. You couldn't void that song. That was number one for a good few weeks, I think.
Yeah, and in a nod to your new homeland, there was a song on the top on the charts that was number seven. That was the only by a New Zealand band called Op Shop. I don't know if you ever heard of them, but I'm gonna play Op Shop's One Day. Which apparently was a big deal for a little while in New Zealand. And so now we both know Op Shop.
I don't think they ever made it to the UK, but
I don't believe so. I was doing a little research on it, and I found out that the lead singer did the Masked Singer in New Zealand and won the competition at one point. So, you know, I guess they were big enough to be has-beens and make it on reality television. It's not a bad song, but again, very slow and not something looking to listen to. What would you, what's your favorite band? Like that you said, you're rock and metal. What do you listen to most of the time?
I do listen to a wide variety of things, but like my favorite, you know, if you're saying like my absolute favorite bands, it would be things like Metallica, Led Zeppelin, Black Sabbath, you know, Pantera, Tool, Typo Negative, you know, these sorts of things, you know.
Is there a particular Scottish band in that genre that maybe people in America would know about?
Scottish band. It's weird. The Scottish bands I listen to there's not a lot of metal comes out of Scotland. Hmm. There is some metal bands. There is a kind of comedy metal band called Aylstorm, which they make what they call pirate metal, and they're quite amusing. I wouldn't necessarily say one of the best bands, but like no, we produce more. We're bigger on like indie bands and stuff like that. You know,
Franz Ferdinand is Scottish, right?
Franz Ferdinand is Scottish, yeah. Things like Travis and the Jesus and the Mary Chain, Teenage Fan Club, and bands like that. We're big in indie, and also Mogwai are a great band.
Oh yeah,
they're like a post rock band. So like they're but no, there's not a whole lot of metal from Scotland. It's but
I wonder why that is. That's interesting.
I'm not sure because metal kind of came from the UK, you know, like the early metal bands were like Black Sabbath and stuff like that. And obviously there's massive metal bands from Britain, but they're mainly English, you know, when you look at the really big ones like Judas Priest and Iron Maiden and, you know, all those kind of guys. Yeah, they're mainly English.
And you got a lot of metal coming from Scandinavia too. Your Finnish and Swedish bands and stuff.
That whole area, Norway as well. Yeah,
just skipped over Scotland. That's I wonder. That's a really. I'd like to see somebody look into that.
I mean, there is a metal scene, but there is no kind of ones that have kind of broke through like big. I would say, you know,
I think it's the accent.
I don't know. Like, this is metal sung in a lot of different accents.
That's true.
You know, like you say with the Swedish and Norway and all that kind of. Germany is big in Germany as well. And there is a band called Bleed From Within. They're pretty good. They're from Scotland. They're a metal act as well. So, yeah.
I'll have to check that out. Definitely would like to hear that. So let's take a look at the TV charts. This was a really low point for television in America. Seven of the top 10 slots were reality television, which I know we adopted a lot of that from England and from Great Britain, because a lot of that was adapted out of that. But man, we just took the ball and ran with it. American Idol was the first two spots. And then in third was a show called The Moment of Truth, which I don't know if it was an adaptation. A lot of them were adaptations from British television. But do you know what The Moment of Truth is?
I've never heard of that. Like, I generally don't watch reality television. Like, I never, in terms of like the American Idol, the X Factor, all the talent ones, I don't really watch them. Never watched like Big Brother or anything like that, or Survivor. So like, I'm not like a reality TV guy, really.
we would get along very well then, because I hate reality television. But this one really stood out to me because, I had no memory of it myself, but it was the number three show in America for this time period. Jesus. Contestants would answer a series of 21 increasingly personal and embarrassing questions to get cash prizes. And the answers would be matched to answers they gave while under polygraph. So they have to answer truthfully versus what the polygraph said, or they don't get the money. So, you know, it got a lot of trouble because they were asking questions about people and it was embarrassing them big time. Mm-hmm. Especially in, there was an unaired episode from the second season of the show where somebody actually answered all 21 questions correctly and got the top prize. The problem was she was a member of a secretive polygamous group. And most of the questions were about her polygamy and what took place inside this group. And her final question, this is insane, to get $500,000, her final question was whether she believed her father had had sexual relations with a minor. And she said he did. The truth detector said that's absolutely true, and she got $500,000. Can you imagine that happening on TV?
Wow. But
it never aired it, but like, my God.
That's insane. I can see why they never aired it. Yeah. Although I am curious, like, because they never aired it, did she still get the $500,000?
That's a very good question. It's a very good chance they said,
is that how that works?
No money. We didn't air. We had no commercials. So you get no money. But I'd love to follow up with her because, God, what was the situation after that? Geez. People will do anything to be on television, I feel like.
Yeah, that is true. Well, some people would.
Some people will. Yeah, not me. So the rest of the top 10 featured Lost, Extreme Makeover, another reality show. Survivor, again, two episodes of Deal or No Deal, 60 Minutes, and then a show of particular interest to this show, which was Knight Rider, because the new Knight Rider in 2008 featured Val Kilmer as the voice of Kit the car. Originally, it wasn't supposed to be him, but then Will Arnett, who has done a lot of stuff, including Lego Batman, he was supposed to be the voice of Kit, but he has a deal with GM, and they wouldn't let him be the voice of the car, which was not a GM car in the show. So they brought Val Kilmer in for an uncredited role.
That's ridiculous. But... Yep.
I never watched the show. Someday I'll have to watch it. But I mean, him as a voice of a car, I don't know how entertaining it could really be.
I don't know. I never watched the show either. I mean, I've seen the original, the David Hasselhoff one, but like, I never watched the reboot.
Looking at the box office, Conspiracy reportedly had a limited release, but it doesn't even appear amongst the top 105 films released that week. I'm going to say maybe it didn't get in theaters. I don't know. And I wouldn't expect it to make a lot of money, as we'll talk about the movie. And, you know, I don't think it was very good. But it was a really weird week in movies because there wasn't a single new release in the top 15 in America. The top earning debut was Jodha Akbar, which was an Indian drama set in the 16th century. The box office was led by the action film Jumper. Do you remember Jumper?
Oh, yeah, the Hayden Christensen thing.
Mm-hmm. That earned $36 million in its second week at the box office, followed by the family fantasy film The Spiderwick Chronicles, which I never saw. I don't know if it's any good or not, but it was up there at number two.
I vaguely remember I might have seen that, but no, nothing's really coming to me. It's like, it's a bit like Jumper. Like, I definitely know I've seen Jumper, but like, I can't remember. I remember it's a sci-fi thing with Hayden Christensen. That's it.
I feel like it came out the same time as Looper. And like, I'm like, are they about the same kind of film? Like, you know, jumping through time or space or whatever, maybe. I'm not so sure about it.
Yeah. I think Looper was hazy. A few years after, but yeah.
And number three was Step Up to the Streets. So there was a bit of something for everybody at the top. And the rest of the list, this is just a mishmash of films, including one called Definitely Maybe. Do you remember the film Definitely Maybe?
Definitely Maybe? Is it yeah. like, do you know what? I might. I'm not sure. Is it like a romantic comedy? Does it star Jared Butler?
No, it has Ryan Reynolds, but it is a romantic Ryan comedy. It's Ryan Reynolds and Rachel Weisz. And
okay. It's kind of thinking of something else.
Well, I think I know what you're thinking of. I can't remember the name of it, but he plays like a television producer or anchor or something like that. Who has a relationship with his producer or anchor, one or the other way around.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure I know what you're thinking of. But this one was kind of a weird one because it was the story of a couple getting divorced and telling the daughter about their divorce. And that's how the film unfolds. And that's like just a weird concept. And not one that I remember at all. I don't remember ever seeing that one. Didn't make a big impact.
Obviously did not, because I thought it was some other film starring Jared Butler.
The only other interesting film on the chart that week was Hannah Montana and Miley Cyrus' Best of Both Worlds concert, which managed to earn $5 million, but it was only in 685 theaters. That's pretty impressive to make that kind of money in just a small release like that.
Yeah. Those are pretty decent numbers. Yeah.
Obviously, Hannah Montana was a big deal for a while there.
Yeah, it seems so.
So we are going to take a little break, and then we'll be right back to talk about Conspiracy. Welcome back to KilmerCast. Let's get into this film. So Conspiracy was written and directed by Adam Marcus with his co-writer and wife, Deborah Sullivan. Marcus has some really interesting films on his resume, having written and directed Jason Goes to Hell, The Final Friday, which was the 9th film in that series, and having wrote Texas Chainsaw, which was the 7th film in that series. Are you a fan of those films?
No, not particularly. I will say they're not good films, but I will say though that because I am a horror guy, as people might have guessed, that one of my podcasts I host is New Horror Express, but Friday the 13th is one of my kind of favorite kind of guilty pleasure franchises. Mm-hmm. In that most Friday the 13th films aren't particularly good, but mm-hmm. most of them are entertaining. Jason Goes to Hell, The Final Friday, is a truly terrible film, but. Some of the outlandish choices that are made are so jaw-dropping that you're like, wow, it is just compulsively watchable. It's like, what? Like, Jason's like got like a slug demon now, and there's a guy with a sword for an arm, and
yeah,
like,
why not?
What is going on in this movie? Go like.
Yeah, it's kind of weird that this guy gets like these later entries into these series, and just like they just go, hey, do whatever you want. Like, it's just like nobody cares at this point.
Just create mythology that's never had any place in the franchise before. That's fine. That's fine. Yeah, who cares?
Yeah, other than those films, his filmography is mostly just a mix of shorts and indies, including his most recent production, Secret Santa, in 2018. Nothing about it, his lineup really stands out, and it's nothing that I would have heard about Adam Marcus in the past. So I didn't have a lot of high hopes coming into this film.
Neither did I. I mean, like, I did see it was directed by Adam Marcus. The only, it was just those two that I had seen, so I didn't have high hopes for it, particularly either.
So in this film, Kilmer plays Spooky, who is a retired Marine, and he had a traumatic incident in Iraq where his team was blown up by a child with a backpack bomb, which I didn't expect when that happened. I was like, oh, that's interesting. That's something that came out of nowhere, this child with a backpack bomb.
Yes. But like a lot of these things in this movie, everything's kind of comically done in that, it's like it kind of comes out of nowhere. And you're like, there's lots of scenes in this movie you think like, oh, that could be effective if done differently. Mm. And this could be effective. It's like, oh, like there's all these terrorists around and they're killing all the terrorists and stuff. And then it's like, oh, but it's actually the little girl who blows them up. Mm. But because it's, and I suppose if you'd done it, if it kind of came out of nowhere, it might be more effective. But it's like you hear like this giant click ticking sound of like,
oh, yeah.
Tick, 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 tick. You know, like it's like a comedy bomb she's got in her backpack.
It's definitely a bit over the top, and that's one of the things this movie has definitely got as its MO is it is not subtle in any way. There, it goes over the top anytime it has an opportunity to.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
So Spooky is suffering from PTSD as a result of this attack, and he's got like these disjointed memories. And I wasn't really sure at the beginning whether it was the movie made no sense or he was suffering from this problem, because there at one point he's sleeping with two different women who's speaking two different foreign languages. She suddenly disappears from the scene. And I really wasn't sure if it was because his mental state was all messed up or they just screwed up the continuity of the film.
It's really badly done. So, you know, like, yes, the first like 10 or so minutes of this movie are so confusing. And I kind of get what they're trying to do. They're like, oh, it's like this thing of like he has PTSD. So it's like these kind of fractured memories. Everything's kind of jumbled. So his head's in the past and then he snaps back into the present. And you know, you can kind of see where they're coming from, but it's so kind of confusingly edited. It just becomes nauseating, all this flashing back and flashing forward. And also, so again, some of it's quite funny because there's a bit where there's like a slow pan to his face when he's in Iraq in 2005 as a soldier, and then flashing forward to where he is in the present, and then flashing back and flashing forward. And he has this really kind of blank, moody look on his face, so we know he's tormented. And then, like, that kind of ends because this woman just, like, climbs on top of him, and it's really poorly shot because, like, suddenly the camera just goes dark because the woman goes in front of the camera. And they didn't, like, bother to be like, they were just like, that takes fine. That's okay. We'll just go with that.
Yeah, I think their whole focus was, did we see her boobs? Yes, we saw her boobs. We're good. We can keep moving. Because, you know, really a pointless scene other than to show this woman's breasts in this movie.
Yes, that was completely gratuitous because there was a bit where they're having like a kind of conversation and she's just kind of doing what no human person has ever done, just like kind of writhing in kind of glamorous poses on the bed, just be like, oh yeah, are you, what you thinking about there, Val?
Yeah, kind of pointless, kind of a weird and bizarre and definitely gratuitous, which, like I said, again, this film has no subtlety because it just goes for things that make no proper human would do these things. And that even goes for the main storyline, which we established early on, because we find out that Kilmer's fellow soldier, Miguel Silva, isn't a citizen. And he's fighting, which I don't know if, you know, in other places in the world have this situation where people who aren't citizens of that country are fighting for that country in the military. Do you know if that happens like in Scotland?
I'm not sure that happens in the UK. I think you have to be like a citizen of some, like, I mean,
it's a very strange situation.
I don't know, like, because I know that I'm not sure how the system works. I remember that in the military, because you can fight in the British military if, you know, you used to be able to, if you were like part of the Commonwealth and stuff. Like, mm-hmm. So obviously during the Second World War and stuff like that, there was a lot of like Indian troops and, you know, people, you know, from other places in the world that were fighting for the British Army. And then like, but I don't know, but I remember, I'm sure I read that like a lot of those people like were given like passports and stuff and then like came over. So, you know, I'm not sure that they're, it's weird. I can't speak authoritatively on it. I do know that, you know, obviously the British Army, because of the Commonwealth, because of the former Empire bullshit, we have a lot of you know, soldiers from other places in the world that are not the UK.
I won't hold you to all this information, but I will say that it's kind of weird in our situation that non-citizens can fight for America and then not be citizens, which is what the story in this film is, that Miguel Silva isn't allowed into this area because he is not doesn't have his family doesn't have paperwork. He has paperwork, but his family doesn't. And we find out that he learned English from reading Watership Down, which I have to say is an impressive feat. Have you ever read Watership Down?
Funnily enough, I have not read Watership Down. I have just seen the movie.
Which is bad enough. I mean, that's hard. That's horrible enough to feel watching that film. It's a terrifying story. Scary stuff. Yes. But Watership Down is not entirely written in English. There's a lot of made up language. That's the language Lapine of the rabbits. So this guy learned English from a book that's not written fully in English, which is a strange idea why this film said, let's choose Watership Down. Because otherwise, why choose Watership Down and make a very big point of it being Watership Down? Why have that be the entry to Miguel Silva?
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Like, it doesn't tie in.
It doesn't tie in with like the themes of the movie either necessarily. Like, if it tied in with the themes, maybe that would make more sense. I'm not sure why it would be that. But it, and like you say, you know, with it, some of it not being written in English, it's like getting learning English from like reading like a Clockwork Orange or something, you know.
Yeah. it's a very strange choice, and this movie is full of strange choices. And so I guess in that context, it makes sense that this movie is all bizarre options and bizarre choices that you make for these characters. Because eventually we find out that Miguel wants Spooky to move to Arizona to help him run his ranch. And Spooky makes just no effort to stop this. He just goes, yep. And he sells all his stuff and jumps on a bus. Spooky, I admire his loyalty, true. But what's, you know, he's got issues. He's got serious issues.
He's definitely got issues. It seems like Miguel's like his only, kind of his only friend in the world. Which is weird because like when he's with the unit, he's seen to be like quite charming, quite friendly, like you know, somebody who's respected and stuff like that in the brief moment we get of him. But it does seem like this is now his only anchor to the, you know, like his only true friend in the world. I was just thinking a bit more about the Watership Down thing. I mean, like the only thing I can think of is it's like a joke. That it's like, you know, this grown man's like favorite novel's like a kind of children's novel. I don't know.
It'd be a very strange choice if we're supposed to care about Miguel as like a sympathetic character, and then you make him out to be like a child if he doesn't, you know, like that's.
I don't know. It's just a weird thing. Yeah.
I get it. Like it certainly seems like something this film would do. As we see one of the child characters later on, it has a weird opinion of children in this movie. Well.
Yes.
So
we should definitely talk about like when that child appears, because
yes,
like,
that child that we will talk a lot about.
That is also a very funny scene. Like I think Spooky's like his nickname. He's McPherson, right?
Yeah, William McPherson. But nobody calls him that until about three quarters of the way into the film. We finally
that is true. Yeah. He's only name checked as McPherson. Like what? Like this film's very poor at name checking characters. I had to look at most of the characters up on IMDb. Like, what are these people called? What they're called.
I honestly couldn't even think about who their names were. I just used their actor names because
for sure.
they might as well just be their actor names, because there's nobody references anybody else except for EB, the town drunk, and somehow part of the police force, you know, this mean guy who runs around and with impunity and totally is trying to ruin Spooky's day for sure.
Yes, for sure.
So Spooky arrives and he meets the locals, and they do not trust him in any way. They are so suspicious of why he's there, and we will learn why that makes complete sense.
Oh, I just wanted to mention, like, before he arrives, I'm like, I feel like Val Kilmer didn't really care about this role that much. But there's certain moments where I feel like he's kind of having fun. And one of the moments that I think he's having fun is when he scares the child on the bus before he gets to town. Like that, I feel like he really enjoyed that scene of just scaring a child.
Yeah, he's on the bus riding to this Arizona town, and the kid in front of him leans over the seat and looks at him. And I think he's asleep or kind of asleep.
He's asleep. Yeah.
And then he pulls back down, and then he gets back up again. And Kilmer is right in his face, just like boom, right in his face. And it is a good moment. And you're right. I think that was when he enjoyed it.
Once he's scared the child, he just lies back with this big satisfied grin on his face. I was just like, geez, that's evil.
Yeah, mission accomplished. Well, you know, he's in town now. He's got this guy, EB, who is a drunk and a bad guy, and as well as this somewhat fascist cop who's running around, yeah. Who runs the town, essentially, and he's just being a jerk to everyone. I mean, it's kind of weird. At one point, a kid gets run over by a car and does nothing. He doesn't even stop the people. He doesn't help the kid. He just sits and watches from his car.
Yeah, so I was a bit confused by EB as a character on several levels. One, I couldn't, like, so the kind of villain in the film, like, basically there's like a border patrol force, like, and EB is part of that, but I couldn't understand if he was also kind of affiliated, he was just kind of affiliated with cops, like, because he's part of the border patrol thing, or he's actually part of the cops, but he never wears, like, a cop uniform. I couldn't understand. And also, like, he is supposed to be, like, the kind of tough henchman character, mm-hmm. but the actor they've got is, like, not, like, it's, like, not a tough guy actor.
No, not
and
at
it's
all.
Just, like, you're, like, oh, so you're, but you're supposed to be, like, the henchman guy who's, like, the kind of toughest guy in the town. Like, it feels wrong.
Yeah, he's a buffoon. He's basically a buffoon. And it's a very strange choice to put what seems like a Three Stooges character as the thug for the main henchman.
Yeah, because, like, I thought there was going to be, like, a different main henchman. In that, when we first introduced it to EB, I thought he was, like, the kind of shitty character. Mm. Like, because often in action movies, you'll get, like, a main villain. You'll get, like, a tough guy henchman who's really built. And then you'll get, like a shitty one who's, like, attached to the tough guy henchman who, like, kind of basically hides behind him and goes, like, you know, just to kind of says to the hero, yeah, you're really fucked now. You know, like, you know, and does that. And I thought he was going to be that Weasley-type character. Mm-hmm. But then he was like, no, he's, like, the main henchman. And I'm like, really? This guy?
Well, I think because they also had the hotel guy, who I think was taking more of that Weasley role, because, and he is my favorite guy, the hotel guy out of all the locals, because he cannot improvise at all.
Well, yeah, that is the director, Adam Marcus, playing the hotel guy. The
is
hotel
it seriously? That's
yeah,
amazing.
Yeah, that is the, like, because I've seen Adam Marcus interviewed about, like, Friday the 13th stuff. So, like, the hotel receptionist guy, that is the director, and he cannot act for Toffee.
That's amazing. I had no idea it was him. And I mean, honestly, he is my favorite character just because the effort there is zero. Like, you know, Val Kilmer asked him if there's a room and he, like, no. And it's like, come on, like, you could have tried a little harder, you know, like, just try to act like a villain. Like, you're just some dope.
Yeah, no, he really can't act. And his interaction in the hotel, both interactions with Val in the hotel are just ridiculous, but particularly the second time when he wants to get a room, and then which is another kind of moment which is quite funny, where, like, the guy doesn't want to give him a room, and then Spooky and Val just stares him down, and it's like the scene goes on for what seems like forever.
Yes.
And you're like, oh, is it like, we're just going to watch Val Kilmer stare down this guy for, like, you know, like, minutes tick by, and you're like, there's plot, isn't there? No.
It's funny because, you know, I always pull a clip for the beginning of the show, and yeah. I was trying to find something where Val Kilmer delivered some sort of monologue or line, and it was almost impossible to find anything of meaning that he said. And I looked at that scene several times because I was like, well, he has to say something to this hotel guy. No, outside of asking for a room, he just stares at him the entire scene and then just goes up the stairs and says nothing to him. And I was like, well, like, was it like he had a limit on how many lines he could say while he's doing this film? Like, he's like, I'm not doing anymore. That's it. It's over.
Yeah. That's true. I mean, like, I can imagine it must have been difficult to find a clip, because, like, most of the exposition comes from Jennifer Esposito.
Oh, yeah.
So, like...
Speaking of Jennifer Esposito, she plays Joanna, who is the only woman in town, it seems, which is a whole nother dynamic. You know, it's kind of weird, this whole town of guys, and there's one woman, and she belongs to the bad guy in town, the leader of the town, who's played by Gary Cole, who I am happy anytime I see Gary Cole in a movie, because I know I'm going to get something interesting out of him, because he has such a weird energy to him. I don't know what your feelings on Gary Cole, but I'm a big fan of his, especially like from like films like The Brady Bunch. Like he takes on roles, okay, and gives it a definite spin that's all his own.
Yeah, you know, I love Gary Cole in a lot of things as well, particularly Office Space. I think Office Space is amazing, and you know, he's a really good comic actor. I suppose you can only do so much with this script. He's limited here. It's not his best day out, but you know, like I'm not sure that that's really Gary Cole's fault.
No, I'm not going to blame him for anything that happens in this movie, because it seems like the script is very thin. I think it was mostly like 5 pages of Jennifer Esposito, and then the rest of it was like, "Hey, we have a fight here."
Yeah. It's just like I don't know. Like I don't even know if Gary Cole's part was like written, or if it was just like little blocks where it says like be racist and then think of different ways to be racist. And Gary Cole was like, okay, I'll say stuff about God's country and patriots a lot. I'll talk down to various people of other ethnicities.
That covers it.
That covers the role.
Yeah, and back to Jennifer Esposito. So she has a daughter named Carly. She runs this little shop in town, and Carly is a lot. Carly comes into the scene. She's played by an actress named Stacey Marie Warden. Mm. I don't like to talk bad about child actors. I get it. They, you know, whatever they are, like that's child actors haven't had the experience to do a lot in a lot of life. But man, she has a lot to say and a lot of emotions to go through in about a span of about 5 minutes. She goes angry, excited, you know, mad, like just everything she goes through is sad, and then walks out of the scene. And I don't think we see her again until almost the end of the movie at that point.
Pretty much, yeah. She is an absolute whirlwind in that kind of little library scene where Val goes to get a copy of Watership Down and find more out about Miguel and his whereabouts. She is a whirlwind of emotion. And also, this is another moment in the movie where I really laugh, because when she first enters the scene, Val Kilmer looks at her like he has never seen a child before. He's just like,
they make humans in this size?
Exactly. He just didn't understand the concept. You know, he's obviously, you know, he's come across teenagers before, as we saw in an earlier opening scene, but not small children. It's completely new to him.
No. And you know, once he's done dealing with her and finding out that there's no copies of Watership Down, he grills Joanna about Miguel, because he's been trying to find Miguel. He was taken out to a construction site where Miguel was supposed to have a ranch, but there's nothing there except he found a little clue there, pointing to Carly's corner, which is where Joanna's store. And then when he asks Joanna, she clams up completely. And, you know, it does allow us to find out in a flashback a little more about Miguel, because we find out that Miguel was given a book by Spooky, and he says he bought the book on eBay, and Miguel says, "You bid on an auction for me? That's the nicest thing anyone's ever done for me." What a sad life Miguel lives.
Yeah, I mean, like, these are two, I mean, this needs to be further investigated, this story. I mean, like, the movie kind of throws up kind of interesting stuff, you know, of like, it could have just been about these guys, of like these two guys who are, you know, broken by war and are kind of totally lost. And they are really the only support system for each other. They've not got anybody else to rely on. You know, you could have told a story about that. The movie decided it's not. I mean, the movie's decided obviously it's not entirely interested in any of the major themes that it brings up, which is a lot. There's a lot of it. Like, there's a lot packed into this movie, and it's all kind of skimmed over.
Yeah, because you have the stories about immigration, where they, you know, people need wanting to get into the country, and these people who are, you know, here already, you say no, they don't want them into in this country. You've also got the issues of, you know, the loyalty between soldiers, the PTSD. All this stuff, which eventually just gets forgotten, because, all it ends up being is like just a way to get to the next scene. Like we see eventually when Gary Cole meets Spooky at the town diner or pub or whatever it is, and offers to buy him chili. And he says, no, he doesn't want to get, pay for the chili. And he ends up getting almost in a sort of fight with EB, where EB ends up punching a glass case and injuring his hand and getting thrown into the wall. And then he stabs Spooky in the leg, but shocker, Spooky doesn't have a leg.
It's a fake leg.
It's a fake leg.
I kind of wish there was more moments like this in the movie, because like when it's being like a melodrama, it's really bad and it's a struggle to watch. You're like, oh man, I'm being sapped by this movie. My life force is flowing out of me. But when it decides to go more action-y, it's still bad, but it's kind of fun bad. And this is kind of one of those moments that I really enjoyed because it was so stupid. So EB like essentially beats himself up because he threatens Kilmer, and then he spills milk on him. Kilmer suffering from PTSD, can't punch him because he has this flashback. And then, EB just starts throwing punches at him that after actually Kilmer vomits on him, he starts throwing punches. He throws one punch, which Kilmer like leans back from and hits a glass case. And then he tries to throw another punch. And I don't quite know how he does this, but he manages to headbutt the glass of milk on the counter and cut open his own face. And then, so he just entirely beats himself up. It's hilarious. It's just
And I was really curious because he goes to stab Spooky in the leg, and somehow he pulls the pants up because the knife is sticking in Kilmer's leg. Like it's sticking out of Kilmer's leg. And he pulls his pants up, and it's a metal prosthetic leg. There's not an actual leg there. So what was the knife going into?
I did wonder about that as well. Like there was no padding or anything like on the kind of metal rod of the leg. It was just a metal rod. So you're like, well, it couldn't have stood. It couldn't have been stuck into the metal rod. Like how's that?
Purely an attempt to create that, oh my God, he got stabbed by having the knife there in the leg, but in reality, it wouldn't have worked at all. It would have just hit the metal leg and fallen out. Kind of a dumb, gag to try to scare us that he got stabbed.
Yeah, it is. But
one of many dumb things that this movie, and we'll talk more about, this movie likes to set up visuals that make no sense, as we'll find out later when somehow Spooky shows up in a guy's rifle sight and then grabs him, but he's in a full face shot in his rifle and yet grabs him from right in front of him, which means he would have had to have been quite a distance away to be seen in a rifle sight in full face, but meanwhile it's right in front of, all you see maybe is the tip of his nose in a rifle sight.
Yep, that is very true. There is no logic to that at all, but I will say in the movie's defense that it was one of the more fun moments in the movie.
Absolutely.
It is because like it's just because you see him in the rifle sight and he's got this kind of badass look in his face. And then he has like this glint in his eye to say like, can I swear? I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Okay. And he has this glint in his eye to kind of say like, you're really fucked now. And like, you know, it's like a kind of classic action movie moment. Like, even though, yeah, like you say, it doesn't make a damn lick of sense.
No, I wish there was more of that in this film because the setups are there for all that action fun. And mm-hmm. they don't have that action fun. Everything feels like it's done at half speed. Especially when we get to the big fight in the end, it doesn't feel like a natural, like, you know, fast fight like you'd see in an action film. It just feels like, oh, let's like, it's like almost like the rehearsal made it onto the final film.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I think like the most fun that they have with the action all does come in the last kind of 15, 20 minutes. And it is that, particularly that little section where he does appear in the guy's like kind of rifle shot and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, you get this kind of almost like montage of him like killing people by throwing knives at them. And like, because of like the kind of hysterical way each of the actors go down to their death, and the way they react to it is kind of like the classic way you would in like a kind of school playground, you know, like you know, kind of you know, and like because like the effects are kind of cheap and ropey, like when he cuts that guy's fingers off, you know, again, mm-hmm. that's quite fun. Yeah, if like it wouldn't make the movie any better, but it would make it a much more fun, breezy watch if there was more of that in the movie. Because basically, like when those moments came, I was like, I want, why isn't there more of this? If that had just been the whole movie, I would have been happy with that. I would have been like, this is a bad movie, but it's an enjoyable bad movie.
Yeah, it would have been a fun bad action film. And would I think it's trying to have it too much in two ways. It's trying to be serious, like the scene in the jail when Spooky gets arrested and gets hosed down by these cops and beaten. Which is just such a strange moment in this film because they take his leg off, beat him with his leg, and then hose him down naked. And I'm like, what is the point of this moment in this movie?
Yeah, there's a lot of things in this movie where, like you say, it's like it's trying to be serious, but at the same time, it's kind of too silly to be serious. I mean, like we've not mentioned that the Gary Cole's character is the head of this corporation called Halicorp, which mm-hmm. is the most thinly veiled Halliburton reference in the world, and it tries to make comment on that as well about the corporatization of war and stuff like that. And it, like, again, you know, I don't know about your politics, I'm about of a kind of liberal kind of leftist view,
same here. You
know, so I kind of chime with many of the movie's sentiments, but they're so ham-fistedly done mm-hmm. that you're just like, oh, it's headache inducing. It's just it's just like, yeah, I get what you're saying, it seems like it's coming from a good place, but this is not well written, and this is not well observed satire or, you know,
commentary or anything. Yeah,
no commentary or anything like that.
Do you think that was a CGI'd Val Kilmer or a stand-in?
I wasn't entirely sure. I did read a review on Letterboxd where some guy was like, I've rewound it 3 times and it was definitely a stand-in. I've worked it out, you know, like I thought it was CGI. So I was like, yeah, okay.
Somebody with a lot of time on their hands.
Yeah, I know. I was like, you rewound it 3 times? I was like, okay. Well, like... I've got other things to say. I mean, like, you know, I'm a guy with 2 movie podcasts and I still have other things to do. yeah, I think it might be a stand-in.
I would think so. I don't think this movie had the money to CGI out Val Kilmer's legs. And I also don't think he was willing to do that, you know, naked scene in the jail cell like that either.
Yeah, that's true. It's clearly not the only thing he wasn't willing to do. well, which I think we'll talk about later.
So, you know, as part of this beat down, Gary Cole shows up at the jail and he's like, hey, I want you on my side. You know, I want you to help me stop all these immigrants from coming into America. And, you know, he's like, no, like, obviously Spooky's not interested in helping Cole. And so at this point, he becomes a special forces supermarine because he manages to escape a late night beating in the jail with like five guys, I think, were jumping on him at that point in the jail. But he takes them all on and then steals a police car and then leads the bad guys on the most boring car chase I think I've ever seen on film.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, this car chase happened in complete slow motion. And again, it's a weird thing. It seems like a kind of common theme in this movie where the kind of bad guys defeat themselves because, like, they all kind of huddle into the jail cell to try and get them, but they all seem to kind of, like, you don't get this kind of badass moment where, like Val, like, beats them up with some, like, marine moves or anything like that. Essentially, they just all run into each other, and Val just kind of escapes through them.
He does do that very impressive leap into the car, though.
Oh, yeah.
With a prosthetic leg. I don't know how he managed that one.
I don't know. Like, yeah, he's got those super marine powers. I guess, like, that, again, I suppose this scene in the jail when he's, like, you know, has that conversation with Gary Cole, again, I feel like that's one of the few moments where both are actually putting some effort in. I'm sure Gary Cole was actually putting effort in throughout the movie. It was just a bad script. But, like, you know, it's, you know, there it was an actual kind of fun interaction between them. And I did write down when, you know, I thought it was, like, when he's, like, gives him that offer and then Val kind of snipes back at him. You tell me what happened to Miguel Silva and I won't need to start burning down God's own country. You know, like, I was like, oh, that's you know, that's one of those kind of crunchy action one-liners that I was like, that's okay.
Yeah, they managed one of them, at least.
they manage one of them. You know, I find it hard to just, I just, like, talking to a lot of independent movie directors, I know how hard it is to get a movie made. So, I want to try and find something that I can say nice about the movie, because mainly this is a terrible movie and people should not watch it. But, like, I'm trying to get these little nuggets of things that have provided some minor entertainment.
Well, the chase leads to the edge of a cliff where Spooky's shot by one of the cops and left for dead. Of course, he's not dead. We know that. You know, there's still a movie left in here to watch. And instead, he's taken in by this Mexican family with the help of Joanna, who then tells Spooky everything you need to know about this movie, because it's the entire expedition dump in one spot. He's like, this guy did that and that guy did this. Oh, by the way, I have a tape of the whole thing also, which I'm suddenly going to pull out. I have a tape of Miguel and his family being killed by Cole and his men. And so it's like, well, you know, you could have brought this out a little earlier.
You could have proffered that earlier. Well, apparently she was too scared to do that earlier because of plot reasons. But we had to fill this movie out to 90 minutes. So, like, she couldn't have pulled that one out earlier. But yes, everything is told to you in this moment. Again, one of the movie's kind of so bad it's good moments is when he gets shot and he falls over the cliff edge. Mm-hmm. And there he's I can't remember Gary Cole's character's name. I think it's Rhodes or something.
Yeah.
He's like, you know, like, we'll come back and we have to find him later. And, like, you can actually still see the body in shot. And then Jennifer Esposito, like, when he's, like, in bed, you know, as he's recuperating with the Mexican family, she said, oh, man, it's surprising that you're not more injured as you fell 20 to 30 feet. And you're like, no, I saw it on camera. He fell, like, 6 feet. Yeah, that's...
Like, you
20
basically,
to 30. Don't lie to me, movie. You showed me what happened.
Yeah, you basically had to lean over a little bit to see him. He was right there. all this revelation, all this video footage of Miguel and his family killed, like you said before, it activates beast mode inside of Spooky, and he goes nuts. He kills everybody, sends back EB with his two missing fingers as a message, and like you said, he's bringing hell to God's country again. Awesome. I thought at this point this movie was turning around. He's got all these awesome kills. He's got this line about bringing hell to God's country. I'm like, we are in for it. Like, this is going to be a great end of this film. And no, because all we get is this fight in this construction site. We get one interesting moment where there's a nail gun involved. Anytime you get a nail gun involved in an action scene, thumbs up. Like that, you know, yeah, that's some danger. Sure. And he even gets his hand impaled on a nail. So I was like, oh, yeah, even grosser. And you know, that's a lot of fun. But while this is all happening, Joanna is going back for Carly. They finally see Carly again after the entire movie has passed and we finally see Carly again. But Cole is waiting for her. And I was kind of impressed here because she pulls a gun on him. And I was thinking, oh, she's not just going to be a damsel in distress. She can handle her own stuff. But unfortunately, then he had backup. And she, just to make sure you know that Gary Cole is evil, he punches her in the stomach. I was like, oh, that's a step you don't usually take with your bad guy, is have him punch out the woman in the film.
Yeah, that's very true. But yeah, and then she kind of snaps back to being kind of, yeah, damsel in distress or whatever. So, you know, like, yeah, it kind of briefly sets her up as something different and then immediately throws it out. You know, like, much like most things in this movie, it sets up interesting things only to immediately throw them out. I suppose, like, like you say about the construction fight, it's like, oh, that could be like a kind of cool scene. And there's like little cool moments, but most of it you can't see because it's in the dark.
Yes.
And it's very poorly lit.
And is there a lot of fog for some reason?
Yeah, there is. It's like there's like a kind of smoke machine going in the background for some reason. And like the town's not foggy. It's just the inside of this one building, which is very... And the building's not on fire. It's just foggy for some reason. And then there seem to be a lot of shots where it seemed like it was like a stunt double, like a Kilmer stunt, like a stand-in, because it looked like some of the shots where it's just like his back, it looked like Kilmer but from like 1998 or something, you know, like I was like, oh, that does kind of look like you could mistake that for Kilmer from about 10 years previous, but probably can't assume that.
Well, as this is all happening, we find out that the cop that shot Spooky is actually on his side. And I don't understand where this came from. I nodded off. Maybe I lost track of the film. When did they hook up?
It doesn't say in the film. Do you know what? Like, when this twist happened, I didn't fully predict it, but it did cross my mind. Because he kind of... this character is weird. I think the character's... Foster or something, but like this character is like a weird character because he does the first time he's introduced, he seems like a complete dickhead, totally on the villain's side. Then when he's reintroduced, when Val's getting like hosed down in that scene, he seems like kind of edgy and like he's uncomfortable with what's happening in the town. And then when he shoots Val, he has this kind of look on his face of like, like he doesn't really want to do it. And at that point in the movie, I was like, oh, I wonder if he's like on Val's side or something. And this is this is actually a setup. But I kind of immediately kind of went, like, you know, forgot about it. And then it came up at this point in the movie and I was like, oh, so that was an intentional look on that actor's face. Yeah, fair enough.
Good on him. you could have let us in on it, you know. It would have been nice to give a little more of a hint to us today.
Yeah, no, there was no real hint. It was just literally the guy looks reluctant to shoot him, and that's a little kind of like, there's a little kind of glance between that actor and Val, and it made me think, oh, I wonder if they're in cahoots. But I mean, yes, it could have been much better explained.
And they cover it with the thinnest of lines where it's like, how'd you know I was wearing a vest? Oh, and he's like, oh, you know, the other guy didn't have one. That's that's your whole reasoning? Is that guy didn't have a vest, so he had it?
Yeah, I think this script was written in about 15 minutes. So I don't know if they really thought of watching.
Well, as all this is happening, Gary Cole, as we must have, he shows up to end things. Gives a, you know, as you said, here's his other line where it says, just make him more racist. And he talks about half-breeds and mongrels and goes off the deep end. And then the guy who gave Spooky a ride earlier hits Cole with a shovel and allows Spooky to kill him. And then the town people move, turn on Cole's men, and that's the end. And it's just so abrupt. It's just like, oh, and we're done. My story's over, and we end up with Joanna and Spooky together. Very unsatisfying.
Yeah, because it really is. Because it's really weird, you know, how everything's done in this movie, because like you don't get that much. I mean, clearly it's just like, oh, it's an action movie, so like we're going to have like a romance between these two characters. It's just like one of those things of like it's inevitable because that's kind of thing that happens in this movie. But it's not like built up at all in the film, no. Really. You know, like there's definitely no chemistry on screen between Val Kilmer and Jennifer Esposito. And even with like Gary Cole's villain, it's like I wrote it down in my notes. Like he doesn't appear in the film until the 29-minute mark. Mm-hmm. And then he only like appears like really sporadically in the movie. And you don't get much of him. But you're just like, okay, this guy's, you know, kind of generic corporate evil. Yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. I get, you know, but like it doesn't really go any further than that. And yeah, just very little things leave a true impression on you.
No, it's a film with real pacing issues, because I realized that at one point I was like, wait, how long am I into this movie? And it was like 22 minutes in and nothing had happened. And then when I got to the end, I was like, wait, how long was this movie? And it was only 90 minutes. And I was like, that's impossible. I feel like I've been watching this movie for 2 hours because it's just so slow and plodding. And how to have a 90-minute movie that feels like forever is a really bad look, because 90 minutes is the perfect time for movies, and this movie does not do anything with it.
No, and like you say, that particularly the opening act is a real slog. Mm-hmm. It goes, and the pacing is absolute treacle. Like, I was kind of the same, you know, when Gary Cole appears, like, just around 29 minutes, like that kind of first like half hour is just like nothing has happened. Nothing. And the plot doesn't kick in. The plot really doesn't kick in until that point, like half an hour into the movie, basically. No. You know, and that's when we really get into the proper investigation with Miguel and all that. And it's just like, yeah. And, you know, like that, particularly the opening like 10 minutes where it's just like flashback, flash forward, flashback, flash forward, flashback. It's just like, oh, Jesus Christ, is the whole movie going to be like this? Like, this is so difficult. You know, it's giving me a headache. Mm. And yeah, when he gets to the hotel, I was kind of the same. It's like 15, 20 minutes in, and I was just like, nothing has happened. Nothing has happened in this movie so far. And then, yeah, things kind of happen sporadically. But yeah, and without credits, I think it finishes at an hour and 27 minutes without credits. And it does not feel like an hour and 27 minutes.
Not at all.
It's a long time.
So I wanted to ask you, do you know the film Bad Day at Black Rock?
Yeah, right. So I read up a little bit about this movie. And so I know it's a kind of loose reimagining of that film. I've never seen Bad Day at Black Rock. I'm aware it's a 50s Western, Spencer mm-hmm. Tracy or whatever. But I've never seen it. Have you seen
it? Yeah, this movie really should have an adaption credit, because okay. It is almost beat for beat the same movie as Bad Day at Black Rock, to the point where, well, although in that movie it's a one-armed man, not a one-legged man, right. Who shows up in this small town looking for his ethnic friend who he fought with in the war. And mm-hmm. like, I'm telling you, so much of the film is just beat for beat. He shows up at the hotel, they won't give him a room. That scene where they take the sheriff's badge off the sheriff that won't shoot and put it on the other sheriff, that's mm-hmm. in the movie. That's in Bad Day at Black Rock. I mean, the fight with the tough guy in the bar where he beats himself up, that's in that movie. It's like, it's amazing that they just took this movie and just went, yeah, we'll just, it's our own movie. It's not a direct remake or anything like that. It is insulting that it doesn't have some sort of credit story by or something like that.
That is mental. Like, I suppose, yeah. No, like I say, I haven't seen that movie. But that's crazy to me that it's so direct, and it doesn't even have any credits saying like an adaptation of, or like, you know, whatever. Yeah, like the movies it kind of reminded me of the most that are actually far more entertaining but still not very good movies is Like, I suppose, like, I was thinking, this feels very much like it should be a Steven Seagal film.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, you know.
Tough guy, like, against the town.
Tough guy against the town, yeah, you know, with a kind of liberalish message and stuff like that, and some kind of patronizing commentary towards minorities. You know, like, you know, like, well-meaning-ish, but, like, still patronizing. Like, yeah, so, and the Steven Seagal film that it reminded me most of was Fire Down Below. Where he goes to a town in, like, Kentucky, and there's, like, a conspiracy. It's all to do with an environmental thing, and it, you know, like, and he has to rescue the town, basically, and unfold the conspiracy. And but at least there's some more fun action sequences in that. It's not a good movie, but it's a far more entertaining movie than this film.
And
it
kind
of also reminded me. It kind of also reminded me of the Jean-Claude Van Damme film Desert Heat as well, I think, just because of the deserty setting, which again is a movie. That movie doesn't have a conspiracy, but it does have, like, a biker gang who beats up Jean-Claude Van Damme and leaves him for dead, and then he has to take on the town bad guys who everybody's scared of and saves the town and stuff like that. So it does very much feel like one of those guys should have been in this film, either Van Damme or Seagal.
It's funny you should mention this too, because when we get to the game, there's a very good reason for that.
So, I do want to mention something, but before
absolutely.
We move away from this film,
go for it.
I like you, I've listened to your podcast. I know you love doing research, and for my podcast, I love doing research too. So I thought I'll try and research this movie as well. And I couldn't find basically anything on this, because it's really there's nothing there. I did, however, find one interview on YouTube with Adam Marcus, because Adam Marcus is on a bunch of horror podcasts, usually talking about Jason Goes to Hell or whatever. But there's this one interview that has him talking about Jason Goes to Hell, but talks a little bit about this movie.
Really?
And the thing that stood out in my mind, Adam Marcus really did not enjoy working with Val Kilmer. In fact, he says in the interview that Val Kilmer is not the worst actor he's ever worked with. He is the worst human being he has ever worked with. Because apparently Val Kilmer was wanting to kind of show off his new Crocs, because, like, the Crocs were, like, a new thing in America, whatever, at the time, around 2008. He wanted to show them off, and Adam Marcus wasn't paying attention to him. So Val Kilmer kicked him in the nuts and walked away laughing. And then the more serious thing that he said, and this is something Adam Marcus said, I don't want any liable for this, is that he sexually harassed Jennifer Esposito, which is obviously much more serious and worrying. But I cannot confirm that. That is only from Adam Marcus's mouth. Please, that's it. There's no liable on my part. I cannot. There's no further sources on that. Just this one Adam Marcus interview. So we only got his word. But, like,
it's pretty bold to come out and say that either way.
Yeah. I know. That's certainly an accusation. But I was like, geez.
Thank you for doing that research. That's very valuable. Well, we have had our say about this movie, so let's hear some from others.
Come, children, let's explore the kills and valleys.
So Kills and Valleys, the best and worst reviews of this movie. On Rotten Tomatoes, Conspiracy has no score because it only has two qualifying reviews. One of them from Richard Roper, who said it's beyond dreadful. It's jaw-droppingly bad. And the other one was
fair
from
point, Richard.
While Brian Orndorff wrote, the entertainment value of Conspiracy boils down to Val Kilmer and his lethargic demeanor. I refuse to crack wise about his recent weight gain, but one can easily spot a slowing of response from the actor. And perhaps it's his boredom with the script. Kilmer doesn't put in much of an effort here, but that's more than what's typically offered to a frayed actioner like this. So, you know, definitely both of those reviews, can't argue with those.
No, you can't argue with that at all.
Yeah, this movie really feels like something that nobody has really watched. Because over on Amazon, the unwashed masses have left us just 265 reviews, which is so small for a Val Kilmer film, because he has a very loyal fan base. And they often will come and review his movies, only 265. And of that, only 39% were 5-star, which, again, Val Kilmer films usually get 5 stars like crazy because the fans are so dedicated to them. This one, not so much. But here are some 5-star reviews that I found. Another good DVD to watch. Some people can write a book on nothing. I can't and won't. All I can say is I liked it. I think you will too. I don't even know what that means.
What? No, I can't parse the logic of that review either, but okay.
Sure. For a free movie on Amazon Prime, it's one of the good ones. Plus, if you attracted to naked, old, out of shape Val, there is a pleasant surprise for you fans. Gotta think more along the lines of old man heroes like Rambo. Yeah, I don't know if that's a treat. One-legged sure naked Val Kilmer. If it was him, I mean, one-legged naked Val Kilmer, not really most people's cup of tea.
No.
Now, I have to remind you, when I read you this one, this is a 5-star review.
Okay, cool.
I have a friend who plays one of the terrorists in this movie. This movie is horrible, by the way. Val looks a little too pudgy and out of shape to be a Marine running around on the battlefield. Also, the point where he and the small-town sheriff become last-action heroes together and start flipping guns around like they've known each other all their lives is mind-numbingly dumb. However, my friend is in it, so I'm giving it 5 stars. You won't know who he is, but he's the best part of this movie. I'm biased, and I don't care. We deserve better. That's a 5-star review.
Wow. So, like, his friend said to him, I'm in this movie. Can you please give it 5 stars? Because probably not many people will see it, so, you know, to boost its rating. And then the friend has accepted, but is clearly accepted only on the terms that they can give their truthful opinion on the movie, but just literally give the rating, which... That is a weird deal to strike.
Is that a good friend or the best friend?
Oh dear. Yeah. I think you have to be a best friend to get away with that, of being like, you know, no, I won't lie about the movie, but I will lie about the rating.
I have no compunction about that. 27% of the Amazon reviews were 1-star, which makes more sense than 27%.
That's a fair point.
One knows it's crap 15 minutes in, so finishing the movie is more or less a zen exercise, a way of tuning out. That's fine. I'm glad some decent actors found work despite the abysmal framework and 8th-grade script they were forced to interpret.
I mean, yeah.
Yeah, you can't argue.
It's fair. You can't argue with that review. It's fair. People got to work.
Yeah, people got to work. Now, this next one is representative of many of the reviews, the 1-star reviews I found on this one, because there's definitely a group that was unhappy with this movie. See if you can figure out who they were.
Oh, okay.
The film is written so obviously towards anti-American pro-socialist agendas that it's painful to the ears to hear them try to act it out. Holly Child Diddler Wood is at it again with this flick. Buzzwords fill the script, and they have a single action semi-automatic clicking as if it was a double action.
Yeah, I looked at some of the IMDb reviews, and some of the most negative reviews were very much a kind of like, this is typical Hollywood propaganda. Yes. You know, like every white person is evil.
Yes.
You know,
if I did like, a fine for every time the word anti-white came up in these reviews, it was often.
Yeah. I definitely saw some of that. I just kind of. Those are the kind of reviews I just roll my eyes and move on from.
Yeah. I like that his real problem with this film is the fact that a gun sounded differently than the gun that it should have been. That's his real problem with this one.
I love that. Like when you read reviews of action movies and you get like real gun nuts who are just like their sticking points are always that, you know, always things like that of like, it was like an automatic, but it fired like a semi-automatic. What is this bullshit? Like,
who cares? Something.
It's like, yeah, I'm not paying attention to that. I'm not like, I don't care.
No. So we have a decision to make.
With or without Val.
Do you think Val Kilmer makes or breaks this film?
I don't I'm not sure. Like, when I mean, some of the most amusing moments in this movie do come from Val Kilmer. Mm-hmm. And I do feel like when he decides to use his natural charisma, it is good. Like, his little conversation in the jail, he shows a bit of charisma there. There's certain other parts, like, when he says, you know, hell's coming to God's country to EB and stuff like that. And he has these little kind of badass moments there. But, they're so fleeting. I just wish that he could have invested in the role more, maybe. Yes, because I suppose he does kind of make it, because, like, when I think back on this film, some of the moments that, like, put a smile on my face were the kind of little kind of cheeky Val Kilmer moments, and even, like, stupid shit, like when he scared the kid and stuff. So, yes.
Yeah, I think, like, if you replaced him with another generic action hero, this would have been unbearable. It's not good as it is, but it would have been unbearable without him in it.
That's true. Because you at least get, like, a little bit of his charisma in this movie. And, yeah, if you put somebody else in that has less acting chops, maybe it'd just be, like, yeah, it'd just be painful. So, well, I'll go with yes.
Why not? So, we have a game to play. It's called Lights, Camera, Action Heroes. Okay. So, as you mentioned before, this feels like the kind of film that Seagal or Van Damme would do. And so for today's game, I'm going to give you a film and a character that the actor plays, and you're going to try to tell me if that film stars Steven Seagal or Jean-Claude Van Damme.
All right, okay.
We'll test your action chops here.
Oh, no. I hate being put on the spot. Like, I've seen so many of these movies, but this will be where I flop.
Well, that's the thing with these characters, is that they're so generic sounding and the movies are so generically titled that it could be anybody, most of them.
Okay. Yeah.
So the first one is the character of Louder in China Salesman.
Louder, China Salesman.
And there's no trick questions, that they're both in the movie. So.
Oh, okay, cool. I don't think they starred in a movie together.
I don't think so. Maybe. Were they in Expendables?
No, because I can't remember the reason Steven Seagal ended up not being in Expendables, but he doesn't see eye to eye with one of the producers of the Expendables or something. And then that's why he never got, like, offered. Van Damme was in the second one, but Seagal wasn't in any of the three. China Salesman, Louder. I'm going to go Seagal.
And you would be correct. Steven Seagal was the star of China Salesman alongside Mike Tyson.
Oh, wow.
It's a strange
film. When was that from?
2012, I believe, if I remember correctly.
Okay.
It's pretty recent. Okay, how about Philip in Kill 'Em All?
Kill 'Em All. God, that's such a generic title. It's one of those. I know that Seagal was in a movie called Kill Switch. I don't know. Philip. Seagal often has, like, funkier names than something like Philip. So I'm going to go Van Damme.
I like your way of thinking. It is Van Damme. You are correct. There is logic to this game. The next one is Vincent Brazil in Assassination Games.
Assassination Games. Vincent Brazil. I have definitely heard of Assassination Games. Seagal?
That one's Van Damme.
Damn. Okay.
Yeah. How about Colonel Robert Sykes in Code of Honor?
Code of Honor. That's Seagal, right?
You are correct. That is Seagal.
Yeah. I think I've seen that.
The next one is Samson Gall in Six Bullets.
Six Bullets. I'll go Van Damme.
And you would be correct. It is Van Damme. You're killing it. This one's a harder one. The director in The Perfect Weapon.
The Perfect Weapon. The Perfect Weapon sounds like more of a Van Damme title to me than a Seagal one.
It is Seagal in The Perfect Weapon playing the director. How about Commander Marshall Lawson in Attack Force?
That's Seagal.
Oh, you know that one, huh? That is correct. It's Seagal.
I've got a book called Seagalology, but it only goes like the guy who wrote it. It only goes up to like 2009 or something. It's a very entertaining book. It's by Ain't It Cool news critic or former Ain't It Cool news critic called Vern, and it's a very entertaining book. So I've heard of that one.
Richard Brumaire in The Last Mercenary.
The Last Mercenary. I'm going to go Van Damme.
And that would be correct. Van Damme is Richard Brumaire. I thought that might give it away with the accent.
Yeah, the kind of sounding name. I was going to say French sounding, even though he's Belgian, obviously.
Yeah, they're in the same family. Professor Robert Burns in Out for a Kill.
That's Seagal. That's another one I'm genuinely aware of.
You are right. Although
I've seen that one. It's truly, truly terrible. He plays like a famed archaeologist. It's very funny.
The idea of Seagal as a professor is very funny, in my opinion.
Oh, it is just as funny watching the movie as you would imagine it is. Yes.
And how about Anthony Stowe in Until Death?
Until Death. I'm pretty sure I might have seen this one. I'm pretty sure that's a Van Damme flick.
And you would be correct. And you went 8 for 10 on Lights, Camera, Action Heroes. Way to go.
Oh, nice.
You get to keep your crown as all action all the time.
Yeah, I don't have to retire the action podcast.
Yeah, I forgot to mention that at the start of the game, that if you lost, you had to give up the podcast. I should have probably mentioned that. But thankfully, you get to keep it.
Ah, that's so cool.
Well, that's it for this episode of KilmerCast. I'd like to thank you, Scott, for joining me to chat about this questionable use of our time.
I mean, I think about that a lot. I think you've covered a lot of wacky 90s action movies. So, like,
do you have anything you'd like to plug?
My two podcasts, All 90s Action All the Time, which actually the new season, I'm not sure when this episode goes out, but like the new season is just about to start. That's all about Val Kilmer. We will be covering 5 Val Kilmer movies in November and December of this year, from the 90s, obviously. And you can check that out on Anchor, Spotify, Apple Podcasts. And if you want to comment to us, you can at Twitter at 90s Action. And the other podcast is like an interview podcast where I interview horror movie directors and writers and actors and all sorts of different things. That's New Horror Express. That has its own website, newhorrorexpress.com. Can be listened to anywhere you listen to podcasts. And again, if you want to send us a comment, you can at New Horror EXP on Twitter. And I also have a Facebook page for that one, New Horror Express. Just search that. And yep. That's all the things that I've got to promote.
That's awesome. Well, we look forward to getting your ears again next episode. In the meanwhile, please email any thoughts, questions, or comments to kilmercast@gmail.com and follow the show on Twitter at @kilmercast. For myself and my guest, Scott Murphy, thank you for listening, and remember to keep it Kilmer.